Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Wow, what an experience to be a part of the Tokyo Olympics.
It's so etched in my memory.
It's one of the pinnacles of my athletic career.
On the Podium is the podcast where Olympic and Paralympic athletes share their remarkable stories. From the struggles,
lots of sacrifices, lots of hard work, tears, a lot of things that the outside world doesn't know,
to the victories.
In the waffle, I could do anything that anybody else could do.
On the Podium from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hi, I'm Nancy. I'm from the United States, and I'm going to be talking about why dogs make you so happy.
I'm Toby Cumberbatch, and I'd like to shed a little light on Happy Pod.
I'm Catherine in Ithaca.
And I am Farah in Ithaca.
And this is the Happy Pod.
This is the Happy Pod from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in this edition, uploaded on Saturday the 19th of August, improving the representation of disabled people in film and TV, and the director pushing for change.
Disabled kids in particular, disabled talent, needs to be able to dream, and I think we're starting to make steps to do that.
The Ukrainian soldier who became a ballet star after losing both legs in the war, also in this edition.
Yeah!
Yeah! Yeah!
The rescue of four surfers who spent 36 hours lost in Indonesian waters. We'll hear about the increasing evidence for the health benefits of even brief interaction with dogs.
People often think of it as kind of a feel-good, nice-to-have. It's actually more than that.
And the yellow dress and the shock of going viral.
Oh, I mean, horror, I would say. I felt a bit overwhelmed. I was quite horrified, actually.
I was delighted.
One in six people in the world has some kind of disability. But a lot of industries simply aren't that welcoming or inclusive. Jordan Hogg, who's been a TV director for 15 years, is trying to change that. Jordan, who has cerebral palsy, says he has never worked with another disabled director. He and his close friend, producer Jules Hussey, have made a documentary about opening up the industry. Jordan told us why it matters so much.
What people don't realise is that literally everybody on the planet at some point in their life will become disabled. We did a show called Ralph and Katie last year, which was the first ever show to have two learning disabled lead actors. Hardly any people with disability in our industry, so we had to have trainees with disabilities. We're thinking, why isn't our industry doing more? I mean, I always say we're in the industry of making magic and dreams. How come we haven't made these disabled kids' dreams come true to work in our industry? And our main objective with this documentary and this project was to kind of raise awareness that there is all this talent out here with these unique points of views and these unique stories to tell.
But do you think it's improving? Do you think, for instance, the days of an able-bodied actor playing someone with a disability are over?
We're in the age now where you can't be done anymore. It's completely unethical. We spoke to another wonderful actor called Kurt Jaeger, who used to be in the World Championships of BMX, and he lost his leg in a motorbike accident.
Everyone like that I talk to who's a writer, unless they have a friend who's a wheelchair user, they think the wheelchair is a character trait when it's just a mode of transportation. So to me, like, missing a leg is the least interesting thing about me. What's interesting is my disability is I wear pants and all of a sudden I'm able-bodied. I am treated as a man walking into the room unless I'm wearing shorts, and then I'm treated as a disabled guy walking into a room, and they are starkly different.
I became a better human because of it. I became more honest with myself. I am nicer to other people. Everyone says, well, would you want your leg back? And I say, do I get to keep my experiences? Because if I don't get to keep my experiences, I don't want my leg. And people can't wrap their head about it. I'm like, you don't understand. Losing my leg was the best thing to happen to me. It gave me a level of perspective that I would have never got any other way.
In your documentary, you do illustrate some of the change that is coming to the industry. Not least, a big breakout star called James Martin.
I'm the first person with Down syndrome can win three awards. One is the BAFTA and the Oscar. People with any disabilities will come up to me and say, you've inspired me so much. And I think that's really lovely. I would just say to them, follow your dreams.
How big a difference do you think visibility makes in your industry?
I'd like to see disabled actors playing non-disabled characters and disability just generally not be a thing in our industry. So I think disabled kids in particular, disabled talent needs to be able to dream. And I think we're starting to make steps to do that, but there's still a hell of a lot more to do.
That was Jordan Hogg, and you can hear Directing Disability by searching for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts. Now imagine walking into an art exhibition and unexpectedly seeing yourself on the wall. That's what happened to grad student Farah Bakari at a gallery in Ithaca, New York. The artist was Farah's neighbour, Catherine O'Neill, who had rather cleverly suggested that Farah might like to wear the same bright yellow dress to the exhibition as she was wearing in the artwork. We'll let Catherine describe that painting.
So it has fire and smoke. I think smoke is the most unusual thing about it. And Farah in her lovely yellow dress with her beautiful dark skin. And some neighbours who also live across the street, a little boy looking into the fire, is very lush and there's lots of flowers.
So Farah, tell us about the point when you realised you had been immortalised in art.
I came in and I was walking through the gallery and the other artists were all looking at me and I thought, oh, maybe I just look like somebody that they know. But and then I saw the painting and I was very surprised and was kind of stunned and I was very moved. It wasn't just that I was in the painting, but it captured something that is very true to our street. You know, I was talking to other neighbors in this beautiful garden.
And what's your neighborhood like, Catherine?
I think in the immediate neighborhood, we're very close and go back and forth for dinners and glasses of wine and gardens. But also it's a bit international because several people here, myself and the neighbors on the north side, have refugees from Ukraine and Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And then there's Farah.
I'm from Somaliland and my housemate is from the Netherlands. It's very intergenerational and international. And very close-knit community. And, you know, Catherine is a fixture of our street. My housemates and I always joke about that if the street had a sound, like a signature sound, it would be the children yelling Catherine's name. Like you just hear that name all day long. Catherine, Catherine. She takes care of everybody. She takes people to swim practice, to driving lessons. And that is really wonderful to hear. Even though I'm the one who's in the painting, for me, when I think of Ithaca and our street, it's like Catherine and the other neighbors who I think about.
Wow, that's extremely nice. I don't think of myself as a fixture, but certainly the children who can play a lot.
And so what did you make of the internet reaction?
Oh, I mean, horror. I was hiding for a week. It was horrifying to learn how big it has gotten because I wrote it in, I have a very small Twitter account that's mostly just academics. And I wrote the story and then I went to bed and I woke up and my friend texted me and she told me this and I opened my phone and I was horrified. And I muted everything immediately within a day. All these people were like people I went to high school, I went to college with, would text me. Or like I would try to get on the bus and the bus driver recognized me. I was quite horrified, actually.
I was delighted.
I don't know. I feel like even though the reaction was so wonderful, it's rare that the internet ever has a nice thing to say and they all agree on something being nice. But it's not natural for tens of millions of people to look at a picture of you. Although I love that people love the painting and Catherine's painting and the story.
Ultimately, I was horrified. I thought it was kind of wonderful.
Artist Catherine O'Neill and her friend and neighbour Farah Bakari. And I will, of course, share that painting on social media using the hashtag #TheHappyPod. Now, this is something you might be able to get involved with, a project to deliver cheap, efficient, environmentally friendly light to the many millions of people who live in places where that isn't readily available. Toby Cumberbatch is one of the organisers of the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers' Let's Make Light competition.
For anybody who's ever lived in the dark, I think you soon come to appreciate a tiny, tiny bit of light. When there's no moon and no sun and you're in the middle of a rural area, so there's no reflected city lights, it's absolutely pitch black and you really can't do much. You have to feel your way around. So a tiny bit of light in those circumstances is transformational. So when you talk to people in these situations, you learn an awful lot about light
its usage and what's good light and what's bad light.
Let's Make Light is your competition. Tell us about that. What are you looking for?
There's lots of organizations out there which make lights for this environment, but in general, people cannot buy them or they're just not available. So this competition is asking for a design revolution. So you've obviously got the manufacturing of the light, which we want to consume as little energy as possible, design something which fits into a circular economy, and ideally be something which you could replicate anywhere. It would be self-powered, use very simple machinery. Then nationwide distribution. How do you get this light source and basically take it into the rural areas? And I don't think any system exists like this anywhere in the world. It always stops at the bigger towns or the bigger villages. So to me, the biggest challenges in this is getting it out into the rural areas where you have to know the community, you have to know the culture. And then, of course, there's a big problem, payment, because if you're a subsistence farmer, your income tends to be very variable. So we hope that people who actually understand the problem and think they have a solution are going to be those that contribute. We're looking for ideas in a sense which nobody has had or people have had but aren't well known. The deadline is the end of September, but this is a multi-year competition. And so we see this as very much as a learning year, perhaps using this then to jumpstart a competition which gets better known and attracts more people as time goes on. The winning team will get $4,000 to help develop their idea. And if several good ideas come in, then I think it is our intention to try and help each of those ideas move forwards.
Toby Cumberbatch, and yes, he is related to Benedict, I asked. And if you want to get involved in that competition, just put IEEE, Let's Make Light, in your search engine. Now let's hear from Sophia, originally from Spain, but now living in the US.
That was the sound of bread crackling straight out of the oven. So when bread cools, when you pull it out of the oven, the crust rearranges itself, it expands, and it makes this really happy sound. It sings.
You described it as the sound that brings you joy. You obviously love baking, but you don't just bake. You bake with a purpose. Tell us about the bread you started making in March 2022.
That day, it was March 8th, 2022, I woke up and I was hyperventilating. I was very excited because I had an idea that I had to bake bread in the shape of sunflowers, sell it to my neighbors, and gather the money they gave me and send it to World Central Kitchen. They help disaster victims around the world. I heard about Ukraine and I felt powerless. I had met Ukrainian people before that were so lovely, and I saw images of their country being shattered, and it just broke my heart. But I thought, well, here I am in little Bel Air, Maryland. What am I to do about it? But then I had this realization, this clarity that, yeah, there's something I can do. So I decided to post a picture of this one little sunflower that I made out of bread on my neighborhood page, and all the neighbors were on board. And it's been amazing ever since, and people love it.
Sophia. Still to come in this podcast.
There's some evidence that interacting with a dog makes us smarter.
She's a scientist. She knows what she's talking about. Now, a lot of the stories that we're most interested in don't start from a joyful place, but celebrate the resilience and creativity of people who find a way to use or work with their misfortune. And this is one of those. Alexander Butko was a graphic designer and coffee shop barista when Russia invaded his native Ukraine in 2022. He signed up to fight and lost both his legs below the knee. Now, though, he is part of the United Ukrainian Ballet Company, performing with and without his prosthetics in a work about the consequences of war and human resilience. Oleksiy Gogidze is a fellow dancer and was Alexander's interpreter for us. So what took Alexander to his unlikely new career?
In general, I've been always interested in culture. during the war and after that happened to me, I've been looking for different elements of culture, and Oleksiy Tytuynyk invited me to see the ballet, and when I first saw it, it came to my mind that it's so difficult, and this exact difficulty, it inspired me to try it myself.
Tell us a little bit more about the choreography.
First of all, we've been looking for a choreographer who was ready to work on this piece, and Emma Evelyn agreed to work with us. And first, it was something simple, but it was way easy to me, so I asked her to make it more complicated. And like 2 weeks before the performance, we changed it, and it turned out to be what it is.
And you also are involved in Invictus Games for injured soldiers. All of this is physically very, very demanding. Why do you feel compelled to do what you do?
Even before the war, I was pretty active. So after the injury, no matter how absurd it sounds, I acquired even more possibilities. So I'm still always doing something. So how it was with ballet and Invictus, I just can't sit at the same place all the time.
And just finally, what does it mean for you when an audience responds at the end of a performance?
That means that what I'm doing is a right thing. Because if people around me appreciate what I do, means that it's not just entertainment. And it is what moves me forward. It might give people inspiration and hope for a better future and a better presence.
Alexander Budko and his colleague Oleksiy Gogidze of the United Ukrainian Ballet Company. Now, a lot of us are having to think about weather extremes and how to be prepared for them. And our chimpanzee sanctuary is doing emergency drills with its residents to ensure that they are ready to take cover too. Jordan Garbarino is the chimpanzee training supervisor at Chimp Haven, a retirement home, if you will, in Louisiana. So what's the appeal of working with chimps?
Oh, gosh, don't get me started. I became really fascinated with them. This is my favorite topic because they're so individual and unique. Watching them forge relationships, explore their environment, learning their likes and dislikes, it is just amazing to me. So I've enjoyed getting to know them. They're just completely individual, and that's what drew me to them.
And so this should be a nice, peaceful retirement, shouldn't it? But extreme weather is becoming an issue.
It is. It's been a particularly cool summer. We've had some storms right at the beginning of the summer that kind of took us by surprise with their intensity. But then since then, we've had incredibly high temperatures. I mean, multiple days with it over 100. One of the ways that we're working with the chimps to prepare them for extreme weather is recall training. And that is the process of asking the chimps to come inside with a very specific auditory cue. It is very specific to the group. Each group has a different sound. And we're training them so when that sound plays, they know to come inside their bedroom, get reinforced with popsicles or bananas, and then they can be locked inside safe and sound.
And just to pick up on the different auditory cues for different groups of chimps.
They all have a different tone. They may sound somewhat similar, but they're all a bit of a chirping noise. We've had to kind of scour the internet for some different ones with so many groups of chimps. That we have here, one of our more produced sounds that staff make is a cowbell. So they'll ring the cowbell for a specific amount of time. But from there, we kind of had to source some different auditory cues, such as like a chirping or like a bicycle horn sound. But we also have a chimp here who is deaf. So with this training involving an auditory cue, we kind of had to get creative since she cannot hear that cue. So her specific cue is actually visual. We show her a bright orange frisbee. And that is her pairing with that training. And there was one time specifically that we drove down to the moat, flashed her that frisbee, and she started booking it right up towards the building. It was amazing.
Jordan Garbarino at Chimp Haven. Now, some of the other things that we noticed this week. 16 young activists in Montana won a court case over their right to a clean and healthful environment. The state is appealing, but if the judge's decision is upheld, the state will have to redraft its environmental policies to take climate change into consideration for future power projects. Ricky Held was the lead plaintiff.
We're not blaming everyday Montanans at all. We're not asking them to throw away their tractor keys.
It's not about that. We're asking our state government, who has control over our state energy policies, to protect their citizens and our land and resources.
And Ricky says she's ultimately an optimist.
Just having the chance to live and be part of this world is just a reason for optimism. And it's all a gift. And I want to give back to this world and make it a better place in any way I can.
Now, you might remember that Indiana Jones in Raiders of the Lost Ark really, really hates snakes. Well, now Harrison Ford, who played Indy, has had a snake named after him. A newfound species in Peru has been named Tachymenoides Harrison Fordi to honour the actor's environmental advocacy. He already has an ant and a spider named after him. And the International Coin of the Year Awards have taken place, the highlight of the numismatist's calendar, with the Royal Australian Mint taking two top prizes. Best circulating coin went to the $2 honeybee coin, which has a rather nice sort of golden honeycomb bit in the middle. And the most artistic coin for the 2022 Beauty Rich and Rare Great Barrier Reef. And now to the story of four Australian surfers who were missing for 36 hours off the Indonesian coast in waters known for being home to several aggressive species of shark. Stephanie Prentice told us what happened.
It was the nightmarish plot twist to a dream holiday that none of them had expected. A group of friends from Australia enjoying a trip to celebrate one of them turning 30 were split up by a sudden storm, with half of the group left floating in the sea. The friends had been heading to a remote part of Indonesia to go surfing together, but when the storm struck, it destroyed one of their wooden boats, leaving four of them and a guide bobbing on their surfboards in waters known for being home to bull sharks, hammerheads and even great whites. They had no food, no water, and no way of calling for help. But they did have a positive attitude. They grouped together on their boards and one of them, Elliot Foote, volunteered to paddle off alone and look for help. While he was gone, a secondary boat that survived the storm made it to land and called in rescuers, who searched and searched until they got to the group, 36 hours after they'd gone into the water. A video shows them straddling their boards in a vast expanse of water, exhilarated to be found.
Yeah!
Yeah! Yes! Yes! Woo! Elliot!
Have you got him?
Where's Elliot? That's Artie, right?
Yeah, have you got Elliot?
No. Do you have Elliot? They shouted, concerned for their friend who hadn't been seen for hours. But after another search, he was found as well, alone and exhausted, close to land but unable to reach it. He called the rescue miraculous. And despite a bit, well, a lot, of sunburn and some grazes, the group told press they were all fine and ready to continue that once-in-a-lifetime trip.
Stephanie Prentice reporting. Now, we know that a great many hospitals and care settings invite in dogs to help calm and relax patients. Now there's increasing evidence that even brief periods spent with dogs, good dogs anyway, reduces stress hormones and increases oxytocin, the feel-good hormone. And that can actually have real impact on our health. Nancy G is a professor of psychiatry and director of the Centre for Human-Animal Interaction at Virginia Commonwealth University. So we know that dogs cheer people up, but what's new with this research?
What our study is showing us is some really measurable improvements from having a dog visit them in the hospital. People often think of it as kind of a feel-good, nice to have, but what we're finding is that it's actually more than that. It's really delivering measurable effects to those patients and, importantly, to healthcare staff.
But what if you're just not a dog person or you have allergies or something? Is there any other way that you can get some of these benefits?
A study was done at Washington State University where they had university students interacting with dogs in a library setting, and other students were just standing in line. So they weren't even interacting with the dog. They were just watching other people interact with the dog. Their cortisol went down. Their mood went up. So we still see similar effects even when the person isn't physically touching the dog.
And you've also talked about young people, children who've had short exchanges with dogs in the classroom, haven't you?
Yes, we did a study with researchers at the University of Lincoln in the UK. And in that study, it was with 8-year-old children. And what we found is that the children who interacted with the dog had decreases in cortisol, and they had increases in executive functioning, and it's highly correlated with success in life. So it's interesting because there's some evidence that interacting with a dog makes us smarter.
And the results that you found don't just relate to the immediate time around interacting with dogs, do they? Some of the results can be quite long-lasting.
Some of the findings we're seeing still at a one-month time period. We see the dogs and we think, wow, this is a great mood boost. It must just be temporary, but it's not. It does seem to be a bit longer lasting.
So the big question would be, why?
First of all, we need attachment figures. We need social support. And dogs in particular provide that for us. So we need to care for another living being. But I think it is even deeper than that. Even when we just interact with a dog, we see things like blood pressure decreasing and stress decreasing. And it's possible that this goes back to our long-lasting relationship with animals. Animals, through this process of domestication and selection, have become extraordinarily adept at socializing with humans. They respond to our social cues. They respond to changes in our emotions. So I think it goes back to we've both learned to read one another and therefore sort of benefit from one another.
That was Professor Nancy G in the U.S. And that's it from us for now. Remember, if you'd like to be part of the Happy Pod, you can email us the sound that brings you joy. As ever, the address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. This edition was mixed by Lewis Allsop. The producers were Anna Murphy and Tracy Gordon. Thanks to all the people who made it possible for me to do this from home this week, because yes, I finally caught COVID. Don't worry, I'm fine. And since editor Karen Martin has been busy here... at the Cassiope Festival in Corfu, our editor this week is Paul Day. I'm Jackie Leonard. Until next time, goodbye.
What in the World is the podcast exploring the stories and the issues that you need to know about?
93% of fast fashion workers aren't getting paid a living wage.
The former president is accused of trying to overturn democracy.
How do elite athletes train in and around their menstrual cycle?
Understand more, feel better with What in the World from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts and hit subscribe.
Take on a mission to unlock the real magic of that great Coca-Cola taste, updated with a twist. New limited edition flavor Coca-Cola Ultimate has been co-created with League of Legends. Taste the plus XP and level up by serving it ice cold for maximum refreshment. Scan the QR code on the bottle for unique digital and IRL experiences. League of Legends. Coca-Cola. Try new Ultimate limited edition flavor.